You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The Israeli army arrested 150 Palestinian activists in the West Bank towns of Hebron and Nablus early today who it claimed had ties to Hamas. Meanwhile, the U.S. envoy in Jordan continued to push Israelis and Palestinians back to negotiation talks after a weekend marred by violence. Peace Watch spoke earlier this week with Mustafa Barghouti, Palestinian leader of the National Political Initiative, and we asked him what moves he'd like to see Israel take to show that it's an honest broker in the peace efforts.
One single step. Complete and immediate freeze of all settlement activities. That is written in the roadmap. It should happen in the first stage of the roadmap. If Sharon tomorrow seizes all settlement activities, and if the international observers could prove that Israel really stopped all settlement activities, this would be a beginning of a true end of this conflict. But he doesn't. Mm-hmm. And as long as he doesn't stop building the problem, which is the settlement, as long as he does not stop this expansion policy, this aggression against Palestinians, I cannot believe that he means peace. The trick here is very clear. Either there are efforts to accept the roadmap or there are not. The single most important step is whether he will stop or not stop settlement activities.
And what role would you like to see the U.S. play in this process at this point? Of course, President Bush has crafted this roadmap to peace, and we now see where Secretary of State Colin Powell is in the Middle East. Is the Bush administration moving in the right direction, in your opinion?
Not enough. I spoke to Mr. Colin Powell about 10 days ago when I was in Washington. I think what he should say, what he should come up with now, Mr. Bush also should say it, that Israel must freeze immediately all settlement activities. If he says so, Israel will have to abide. If Israel knows that the United States can exercise and would exercise pressure to seize all settlement activities, then Israel will realize that the United States is serious about implementing the roadmap in a fair manner. Up till now, this did not happen. And believe me, since 1993, actually since 1991, I was myself part of the Palestinian delegation to Madrid. And since then, we've been demanding this specific demand. Please let them stop settlement activities. Let Israel free settlement activities. If that had been done, we would be now dealing with a problem that is much easier to solve. But since Oslo, since 1993 and up till now, Israel has built 102 new settlements and expanded settlements by almost 100%.
Dr. Barghouti, what is your political vision for Palestine beyond the freezing of the settlements?
My vision is that we want not only a Palestinian state. We want a state that is sovereign, a real state, you know, like all other states. Did you ever see a state that does not have borders? We want the Palestinian state to have borders, to be in charge of its borders. We want the Palestinian state to be in charge of its natural resources, of its water, of its sky, of its land. We want the Palestinian state as a place where Palestinians could practice citizenship in a normal manner, without having to take permission from Israeli soldiers each time they cross into their country or out of it, or each time they have to move from one section of their country to another, as Sharon is proposing in his plan. What I also want is beyond that. What we want is to see a Palestinian state that is democratic, where Palestinians can practice democracy, where Palestinians can really reform the structures of the Palestinian Authority that have become so incompetent and so inefficient. We want to have a rule of law. We want to have a constitution that governs people's rights. We want everybody to be equal in front of law. We want freedom and justice. Basically, we want Palestine to be a country where a citizen would be respected for him being a citizen without having to have connection to this man or that group, respecting him as a Palestinian. For 100 years, Palestinians have been deprived from their right of dignity. They have been deprived from their right for citizenship. They've been moved from one place to the other. They've been prevented from having the chance to build up their lives, to build their educational system, their health system, and to live normally like everybody else does. This is the last people almost in the world that is deprived, not the last, but maybe one of the last people in the world that is deprived from the very simple right of self-determination. The same exact right that the Israelis practiced. We want that. We want the state to be normal, not some kind of a colony under Israeli pressure. Definitely not Pantustans or ghettos that Israelis control.
Mustafa Barghouti is the Palestinian leader of the National Political Initiative and the director of the Village Medical Relief Committee. He spoke with Peace Watch earlier this week. Kathy Kelly, co-founder of the grassroots organization Voices in the Wilderness, returned recently from Iraq, where she stood by ordinary Iraqis during what she calls the, quote, U.S. slaughter, unquote. She also befriended young American Marines, many of whom were on the front lines in Basra and Baghdad. Kelly discussed her experiences recently with Sue Cipriano, host of the radio program Stepping Out of Babylon.
People there have been enormously hospitable and friendly to us over the years, in spite of the fact that we came from a country that was causing them really grievous harm. As you can imagine, during the warfare, we became very, very close to the people with whom we lived. We were in a family-run hotel, and we were immediately adjacent to the Palestine Hotel that housed 750 Western and international journalists. And I suppose in some ways we thought, well, you know, if you're going to be next door to a hotel with all kinds of Westerners, maybe there's more protection. But in fact, that hotel took a direct hit. Anyway, we grew very, very close to the people with whom we stayed.
Did I hear that you weren't allowed to work with the other journalists or something? Did I hear something about that?
Well, Sue, that refers to a time after the occupation had begun. We could just by, you know, inhaling realize that there hadn't been any garbage pickup immediately outside of our hotel or anywhere else in the city. We were aware of an outbreak of cholera in a place called Hilla. The non-governmental organizations from several other countries, they had crucial information that we felt that the occupying troops really needed to know, like where are the hospitals and clinics and the storehouses that had medicines. And we ourselves had some questions about what kind of plan this new occupying force had, given the outbreaks of chaos and the disintegration that was going on all around us. So two of our people wanted to go over and talk to the Coalition Military Operations Center, find out something from them and communicate some information we thought would be helpful. And it was kind of a disturbing realization we had when Ramzi Qaisi and Kathy Breen said to them that there was an outbreak of cholera in Hilla, and the person in charge said, now is Hilla a street or a neighborhood in Baghdad? And they said, no, Hilla is a major city in the center of Iraq. When they indicated that they really didn't have any interest in working with the non-governmental organizations unless those organizations could subordinate themselves to the military command, and we said, well, that, you know, these organizations can't do that. They have to maintain neutrality. But could you at least talk to them? Could we come back and talk to you later? Could we talk to somebody perhaps who's higher up? And the word was no, please go. There's nothing you can do. We really shouldn't be talking to people like you. So our group quickly put out a press release feeling that if the kind of nerve center for this occupation couldn't talk to us, then maybe the media could alert them to some of the problems that we thought were so needing of attention. And after that press release went out the very same night, we found that our stationery was laid out on the ground, and in fact they had silver bullets surrounding the letterhead, and there was a word that we were banned from entering the building where the military command had their center and where also 750 journalists were housed. Now, quite honestly, I think that our people go in and out of that building anyway, but it's a sign. I would want to say, though, that most of the Marines that we spoke with when they first arrived shouldn't be characterized as people who were hostile toward us. If anything, that we were amazed at how forthcoming they were. They'd ask us questions like, you know, could you tell us your side of the story? Or could I pray with you? Or could we sit with you for a while? And the commanding officer actually said, don't blame these young men for what happened. In the heat of battle, I made some hasty decisions, and a lot of civilians were killed, and it's I who will have sleepless nights. But it wasn't just him, because quite a lot of them would come over in the middle of the night to watch the television news, the BBC News, or sit and talk, and They told us many things about how miserable they felt about the war and about what they'd done there. That we heard a lot of remorse and regret. Mm-hmm. One young man said, you know, I can't wait to get out of the military as soon as I get back, and I'm glad that I was responsible only to bring up prisoners in the rear, and I didn't use my gun, but I saw others who killed civilians outright when they could have shot at the tires of an advancing car, and that was wrong. Another said at one point they couldn't tell because there were fatigues on the ground whether they were dealing with civilians or military people, so they shot everybody. And then he pointed to his head and he said, I hope that never registers here. Another one said that he did everything he could to jam his gun and not to shoot it. And my hope is that as some of these vets return, particularly the Marines that were part of the group that were engaged in combat on the way from Basra up to Baghdad, that they'll be listened to. Some will feel that they are, you know, proud of an achievement that they might never, ever again accomplish anything greater in their lifetime. But I'm quite sure that others will want to help us with counter-recruitment. Mm-hmm. And as we try to uproot the roots of war in our own lives, in our own circles, in our own society, along with questioning our own lifestyles, which sometimes almost seem to require a war to protect our horrible levels of waste and consumption, along with confronting the companies that make the munitions and considering ways that we can withdraw financial support for military, I think we also need to think about the education systems and the vulnerability that our young people have to recruitment to join the military.
Somebody said to me, well, I was really sympathetic with the Iraqis, but now that I see that they're pulling, you know, tearing everything apart, they really are like, you know, don't know how to behave kind of thing.
Two simple observations. One is that across Iraq there are many soldiers who are home now from the war that we don't want to call a war because we think it was a slaughter. They're at their homes, they have their gun, and they don't have a job. And there are many thousands of people that have been in prison. And Saddam Hussein made the decision, release them all. And they're in their homes, and they have a gun, and they don't have a job. So, yeah, it doesn't take too long to figure out that that's not such a good formula for security. We do have a lot of reason, I think, to wonder, is there any chance, and this is really cynical, I know, but is there any chance that the United States designers of this war saw some advantage in allowing enough chaos to pervade that Iraqi people themselves would say, please govern us? And that, just as you said, the Iraqi people would look ungovernable and appear in the eyes of people around the world as people who don't deserve our compassion. But I am hopeful that people in the United States won't succumb to that. I am hoping that there will be heartstrings that can be plucked. Mm-hmm. And that people who heard the Bush administration say it was going to war because of weapons of mass destruction, and then see no weapons of mass destruction, that it was going to war because Iraq is connected to Al-Qaeda, and then see there are still no signs that would hold up in a court of law of connection to Al-Qaeda. We'll ask, now, why did we go to that war? And okay, if now the United States wants to say, well, democracy and freedom and a better life were made available to Iraqis, well, let's wait and see. And if such is not occurring, if it's not forthcoming, then it's my hope that if Iraqi people engage in a creative resistance, and I hope and pray it will be an unarmed resistance, that they will be able to go right over the heads of the military, right over the heads of the warmongers and the politicians, and reach the hearts of American people and say, we want our chance.
Kathy Kelly, co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness, she was speaking with Sue Cipriano, host of the radio program Stepping Out of Babylon. The Congress of the United States is currently holding closed hearings on intelligence matters regarding alleged weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Questions have arisen about how U.S. intelligence was used to justify the invasion of Iraq. Several weeks after the end of major hostilities in Iraq, no weapons of mass destruction have been found. Howard Zinn, historian and author of The People's History, warned participants at a recent peace teach-in in Washington, D.C., that Americans can easily be deceived if we don't know our history.
History is crucial. If you don't know history, it's as if you were born yesterday. And if you were born yesterday, Well, it means that anybody in authority can get up before the microphone and tell you, oh, we must go to war for this reason or that reason. And if you don't have any history, you have no way of checking up on it. Then you become a victim of authority. But if you know some history, well, you have a basis for checking up on the things that are told to you by the Secretary of Defense or the President of the United States. And you'll then be in a position to check the things they say. Well, we've seen this very, very recently. The government has claimed that we need to go to war against Iraq. I mean, not a defensive war, not a case in which we've been attacked. No, we need to be the aggressor. We need to invade and attack Iraq. And they advance, you know, the reasons for this. And, you know, they advance, well, weapons of mass destruction. Well, if you know something about the history of weapons of mass destruction, you'll be very doubtful that suddenly a nation has emerged, which is the first nation in the world with weapons of mass destruction, and puts us in danger, and therefore we must do something about it. If you knew some history, you would know that there is a long history of other nations having weapons of mass destruction, that eight other nations besides Iraq, and Iraq isn't even there yet, eight other nations have nuclear weapons. And if you want to look into who has used weapons of mass destruction, and this was always one of the claims of the United States, oh, they have used weapons of mass destruction. Who has used weapons of mass destruction more often and with more deadly effect than the United States of America? I mean, which is the only country in world history that has used nuclear weapons on two cities and obliterated those cities? And what about the weaponry in Vietnam that killed several million people? Were those not weapons of mass destruction? Or do they fall into some minor category? So the history would suggest to you that the claim that we're going to war for weapons of mass destruction, you know, doesn't make any sense. And of course, I read, you know, just recently that since the United States, with all of its resources and all of its effort, has not been able to find these weapons of mass destruction, that an undersecretary of defense has said, well, it doesn't matter that we didn't find it. They have the intellectual capacity to produce such weapons. You know, there's a kind of absurdity to that. Who does not have the intellectual capacity to produce those weapons? But then the United States claimed on the eve of war in Iraq that it was going in to because... Well, this was after the argument of weapons of mass destruction began to look weaker and weaker, and suddenly it was regime change. Suddenly, well, we need to overthrow a tyranny. And in fact, Saddam Hussein, of course, was a terrible tyranny. But the idea that the United States was going into Iraq because the United States government was absolutely shocked at the existence of a tyranny in the world, probably the only tyranny in the world, and therefore we must get rid of it, and that the United States would go into Iraq to establish democracy. Well, it doesn't take much history to suggest that this is an absurd claim. I mean, the history of American intervention is not a history of overthrowing tyrannies. It's much more a history of instituting tyrannies, of accepting tyrannies, of arming tyrannies. It's not a record of establishing democratic governments. It's a record of overthrowing democratic governments, overthrowing a democratically elected government in Iran in 1953, again in Guatemala in 1954, again in Chile in 1973. Now, anybody who knew some history would really be very dubious about the claim that the objective of the United States in Iraq, you know, is to establish democratic government. And of course, now we have not only the evidence of history, but the evidence of the last few weeks to indicate, you know, how spurious and this claim is. And then, of course, presumably we were going to do something about terrorism. Ever since September 11th, and President Bush proclaimed a war on terrorism, supposedly every aggressive act that we've carried on, including the bombing of Afghanistan for a year, killing of several thousand people there. Oh, and now the invasion of Iraq. All could be justified in the name of the war on terrorism. But we have not seen terrorism diminished by the actions of the United States. We have seen terrorist acts continue and continue. And it becomes clear that when you invade a country, when you attack a country like Afghanistan or a country like Iraq, you are not diminishing the threat of terrorism. You are increasing the threat of terrorism. And besides, the history of terrorism, after all, is not a recent one. Terrorism does not start with September 11th. Terrorism has been going on for a long time. Terrorism is a fact of modern warfare. The imperial nations of the West have terrorized the Third World countries in order to subdue them. And what did the United States do in the Philippines in the early part of the century but terrorize the people in the Philippines in order to subjugate those islands for the benefit of American power? So a little history suggests that the war on terrorism has, from the beginning, been a fake, that it's been an excuse, a rationale for doing whatever the United States government wanted to do in the world. And I suggest that if you look back through the history of American foreign policy, and you look back through all of the rationales given for American expansion, you will find a common denominator. You will find something that underlies all of the claims that were made in the 19th century about, oh, this is manifest destiny, or we must civilize the Mexicans, or we must overthrow Spanish tyranny in Cuba. You know, if you look back through history and, look, at those claims, and you'll find that behind every one of them is a continuous fact, a persistent fact about American policy that has been true, in fact, ever since the end of the Revolutionary War, that is, ever since the end of the 18th century. And that persistence, that common denominator, is simply the expansion of American power throughout the world. That has been going on for a long time. It starts right after the American Revolution. It starts with the move westward into Indian Territory. The Louisiana Purchase enables the United States to move into an enormous area of the country and begin wiping out or pushing out, really an early example of ethnic cleansing, pushing out the Native Americans. And then we instigate a war with Mexico. Instigate is the right word. We instigated a war with Mexico. It was an aggressive war. And why do we do it? Well, the excuses fall apart, and then it turns out, no, we want half of Mexico, and we take half of Mexico, that lovely territory now out in California, Arizona. And then at the turn of the century, we go into Spain, presumably to liberate the Cuban people. But we don't liberate them at all. Yes, we liberate them from Spain, but not from us. Spain is out. The American corporations are in. And then we move into the Philippines, and in a very bloody war, we subjugate the Philippines. Yes, we're expanding into the Caribbean. We're expanding into the Pacific. We send Marines in the 1920s and 1930s into the Caribbean, into all of those countries. And American power, American corporations follow. And at the end of World War II, we move into the Middle East. We begin to replace the dominance of the old Western empires with the American empire. We make a deal with Saudi Arabia for the control of Mideast oil. And soon we have military bases in over 100 countries all over the world, and as we see now, ships on every sea in the world. You know, that is the common denominator to American expansionism. The war in Korea, the war in Vietnam, all the claims that we're doing this to fight against communism, they all fall apart. The best proof that we weren't simply fighting against communism is that before there was a communist threat, before there was a Soviet Union, before there was the 1917 revolution in Russia, the United States was expanding. After the Soviet Union fell in 1989, the United States continued to expand. So communism played the same role then that terrorism plays today, an excuse for the United States to expand corporate power, political power, military power throughout the world. One other thing we can learn from history, and that is that that expansion is not inevitable. Imperial powers rise and they fall. And we learned from Vietnam it's possible to build a movement against war, a movement that seems impossible to succeed because of the enormous power of the United States, of this, or its military power, and so on. But we've had a lot of experience in the last several decades of how military power is not enough. People power can overcome military power. And I feel confident that in this instance, today, despite the awesome military might of the United States, it rests on a very fragile base. That fragile base is the hearts and minds of the American people. And as the American people learn more and more and have second thoughts about what we were doing in Vietnam, I believe that the power of the people will assert itself here as it has in countries and other parts of the world. And we may yet see the American empire come to a halt and the possibilities for a new society of peace and justice emerge in the United States. So I would suggest that there's no reason to despair. We've seen too many moments of despair which suddenly ended with surprises and with good surprises. And I feel if we persist, if we continue, if we defy, if we resist, if we refuse to be intimidated, we will see change. We will see change in the direction of a peaceful world.
Howard Zinn, historian and author of The People's History, speaking at a peace teach-in held in Washington, D.C. last month by United for Peace and Justice. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Benta Berkland, Stephen Push, Mohammed Owais, Jackson Allers, and Kata Mester. If you'd like to support Peace Watch, we urge you to make a pledge through our secure online website at pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.